Well, it's certainly good to be here this morning. Glad to see everyone that has made it out, the presence of everyone that's here. So for a little while this morning, we're going to talk about the case for the resurrection. I'm also going to try to do something. You know, you can't ever sit still on technology, so I'm going to try something else with my computer, so bear with me here. But we're going to talk about the case for the resurrection. This was Megan's idea for a sermon several months ago, and it was one of those days where I had two lessons, in the morning and in the afternoon. In the morning, I did a lesson called The Case for Jesus. So there was some historical proof that the man Jesus Christ existed, and there's lots of evidence for that. The afternoon lesson was supposed to be the case for the resurrection. It's the case for the Christ. It is the case, looking at it logically and historically, that the resurrection actually happened. And I never got around to writing the second lesson, so we're going to have it today. So for a little while this morning, we're going to study from a little bit of a logical standpoint the case for the resurrection of Jesus. Before we go further, let's go to God in a word of prayer. For a little while this morning, we're going to look at this concept of the case for the resurrection. I think sometimes it's possible that we neglect the importance of the resurrection, because the resurrection is what everything is about. The resurrection tells the story of everything. Without the resurrection, Christianity should not exist. And so I think sometimes this side of the cross, some 2,000 years, we talk about this and we forget how important and how overwhelming the concept of the resurrection was. So we're going to look at this lesson. I'm going to begin with seven random questions. And as we go through the lesson, we're going to answer, hopefully, these seven questions as we try to build our case for the resurrection. Number one. What events can most scholars agree upon? Because there's some people that agree in the resurrection and some people that disagree. And if you look at things in totality, there are several events and several facts that we can agree on. Number two, what is a contrapositive? And so there may be some folks in the audience that know that word. That's just a geometry term. So Kyla, who just finished geometry, needs to know it. And Drew, who is in geometry, hopefully knows it. It is a mathematical term. It's going to be very important in our lesson. Number three, what is the Toledot Jehu? Now, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. That is some ancient Hebrew writing. I'm going to pronounce it just like it looks. The Toledot Jehu. Number four, what is commemorated on Nisan the 26th? That's from the Jewish calendar. What event would be commemorated on the 26th day of that month? Number five, what is the ninth commandment? Number six, is it important that the women saw the empty tomb first? Think about that question. And number seven is, can people really change? What does it take for a person to really change? So we're going to try to answer these seven questions as we go through our lesson, as we make our case for the resurrection. I want to come up with 12 accepted historical facts. There's a man by the name of Dr. Gary Habermas, and he is claimed to be one of the greatest scholars concerning the resurrection. He is a professor at Liberty University. He's an accomplished author. And reading and studying this, I came across these 12 comments by Dr. Habermas. He has looked at over, I believe, 4,000 different documents and studied them concerning the resurrection, some written by people who believe and some who do not believe. And he has come up and compiled a list of 12 accepted historical facts by the majority of all scholars. They'll agree with these 12 facts, whether they believe in the resurrection or not. Number one, that Jesus died by crucifixion. Number two, that Jesus was buried. Number three, after his death, the disciples were caused to have great despair and lose hope. Number four, the tomb was empty after a few days. Number five, the disciples believed they had seen the resurrected Christ. Number six, the disciples were transformed from doubters to believers. Number seven, the resurrection was the central message of early preaching of the church. Number eight, this message was proclaimed in Jerusalem. Number nine, the church grew rapidly in Jerusalem. Number ten, Orthodox Jews who believed in Jesus made Sunday, the first day of the week, their day of worship. Number 11, James, the half-brother of Jesus, was converted to Christianity. And number 12, Paul was converted to the faith after he believed he had seen the risen Christ. And so these 12 facts are basically accepted by everyone, whether they believe in the resurrection or not. Habermas goes on to prune these down to what he calls his top five accepted historical facts, or the minimal facts. Number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Number two, the tomb was empty after a few days. Number three, the disciples believed they had seen the resurrected Christ. Number four, James, a half-brother of Jesus, was converted to Christianity. And number five, Paul was converted to the faith after he believed he had seen the risen Christ. And that's basically these five accepted historical facts are where we are going to build our case today. In recent weeks, we've studied of the great crucifixion and the horrible times and the last days in the life of Jesus. And in the last month, we have studied about the events that occurred after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And using these five, we're going to build our case for the resurrection. The empty tomb. There is nothing more powerful in this argument than the fact that the tomb was empty. So I want you to think about this for a minute. I want you to think like a detective. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little story, and then we'll go from the story and turn it into to the biblical application. I want you to pretend like you're a detective. And somebody comes running into your door, slams the door of your office, says, "You've got to help me." He said, "The food king has just been broken into. And someone stole all of the Bluebell ice cream. And they have wiped out the shelves of Bluebell ice cream at the food king. You got to help me." Well, as a detective, what would you do? What would your first instinct be and your first thought? Because as a detective, you learn real quickly, don't trust anybody. Everybody seems to have an ulterior motive. You better check your facts. So as a detective, it'd probably be safe that you would come up with what's called a conditional statement. This is logical, right? Well, if the ice cream has been stolen, then the freezer is empty. That's called a conditional statement. The most powerful way to disprove a conditional statement is to do what's called the contrapositive. Does it make sense? If the ice cream is stolen, the freezer is empty. But if you were to say, well, if the freezer is not empty, then the ice cream obviously was not stolen. And that's what a detective would do from the very beginning. Someone flies in my office and says, the ice cream has been stolen and the freezer has been cleaned out. Well, the first thing I would do is I would go down to the food king and I would go look in the freezer. And if the ice cream was still in the freezer, I would say, it's right there. Nobody stole anything. Your freezer is still filled with ice cream. Isn't that the most logical thing that you would do? That's because a contrapositive, where you flip things around and you add the word not into them, that is the most powerful logical argument that you could ever have. If someone says the ice cream's been stolen and the freezer is empty, and I go look and the freezer's not empty, then that means the ice cream was not stolen. That's just basic common sense logic. That's called a contrapositive. It's something called a converse. Because things in life normally don't work out quite that well where the facts are quite that easy to find. So a lot of people will try to prove what's called the converse. And they'll say, well, if the freezer's empty, well, then obviously the ice cream is stolen. So I want you to kind of get this picture in your mind. Converse doesn't work quite as well. Because this is where the legal term of reasonable doubt comes in. So if you ever watch any of those Law and Order shows or anything like that, if you try to prove something about converse, people come back and they'll say, well, this could have happened. Well, what about this? What about this? What about this opportunity? See, there's something that maybe could have happened that can ruin your logic. For example, is there a way that the freezer could be empty but that the ice cream not be stolen? Well, what if the freezer's broken? If the freezer was broken, it would be empty, and that's not proof that something was stolen. What if, well, I hate to think about this after it did happen, what if there was some type of problem at the Bluebell ice cream factory, like there was a couple years ago, and they quit making Bluebell ice cream? Well, your freezer would be empty, but it wasn't stolen. See, when you start getting into trying to prove what's called the converse, that's where you get into these variables and these different situations, and you try to think about ways that you could prove something, but it's not as strong as the contrapositive. The contrapositive is the strongest way to prove or disprove something. It's the most logical and the most obvious. So now let's think about the logic of an empty tomb. Here's my conditional statement. If Jesus is resurrected, then the tomb is empty. What would be the strongest, most powerful way, if I was a Jew, to disprove that claim? What would be the most logical way that I can end Christianity in a heartbeat? Well, it would be to prove the contrapositive. If the tomb is not empty, well, then Jesus must have not been resurrected. Wouldn't that be the most logical way to disprove it? It's the contrapositive. If the tomb is not empty, then Jesus is not resurrected. You know, we're told stories in the Bible of all these people that went to the tomb. The women were at the tomb, and Peter and John went and observed the tomb. Folks, I guarantee you, they were not the only people that inspected the tomb. I guarantee you, the Jews inspected the tomb. I guarantee you, the chief priests and the scribes and the high priests and probably the Roman officials, they all inspected the tomb. Because if the Christians are saying Jesus is resurrected, then the tomb is empty, well, all you'd have to do to disprove that is to walk over to the tomb and say he's right there. If the tomb was not empty, then resurrection is a farce and Christianity would have never started. But that didn't happen. There's something powerful to that, that the most logical, obvious way to disprove the resurrection was not done. The Jews made no attempt to prove that the tomb was empty. What did the Jews do? Well, the Jews had to try to prove the converse. They accepted the fact that the tomb was empty. They just had to find ways, the other ways to prove it. That there's got to be another solution than accepting the fact that Jesus was resurrected. There has to be some other way that we can say the tomb was empty, but not accept the resurrection. That's what the Jews did. The Jews did not try to use the most logical, powerful, one-stop opportunity to disprove Christianity, but instead, they tried to prove the converse. So do you understand my logic here? The entire issue of Christianity could have been resolved if the body of Jesus remained in the tomb. The Jews had a problem, though, because the tomb was empty. And so they had to come up with another way to explain it. The Jews appeared to accept this fact that the tomb was empty and instead began to use other ways to prove it, to disprove it. Remember the account in Matthew chapter 28? Matthew 28 and 12 says, when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. Verse 15, so they took the money and did as they were instructed. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. So you understand what happened? The Jews just kind of backed off of the tomb being empty because they realized that that wasn't logical. They couldn't prove that. So they had to come up with a way, an alternate suggestion of how the tomb was empty. Well, they stole it. They took him away. And it says that this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. I came across this writing called the Toledot Jehu, however you pronounce that in Hebrew. This was an early Jewish satirical writing. So written in the form of satire, it was making fun of the Christian religion. It was making light of Christianity. Most people think it was compiled somewhere in the 2nd century. They accepted the fact that the tomb was empty. But they had a whole legend to explain what happened, how it was empty. And I won't read the whole thing because it gets into this Queen Helene and talks about this man who believed he was the Messiah. It says he had ascended to heaven as he prophesied. Diligent search was made and he was not found in the grave where he was buried. See, the Jews accepted the fact that the tomb was empty. Here's how they explained it, though. A gardener had taken him from the grave and brought him into his garden and buried him in the sand over which the waters flowed into the garden. That is powerful to me. That is unbelievably powerful. The most logical, comprehensive way to disprove the resurrection would be to show that Jesus was still in the tomb. They made no attempt to use that argument. Instead, they tried to prove the converse. Well, you know. Okay, the tomb is empty. But that doesn't mean he was resurrected. And here's our explanation for why the tomb was empty. First, they said, well, his disciples came and stole the body while we were asleep. Despite the fact that there was a Roman guard and the tomb had been sealed, they said, somebody came and stole it. And then as the years went on, the tradition became, There was a gardener who had taken him from the tomb, and the gardener had stolen him. I think they missed out on an opportunity. If the Jews wanted to disprove the resurrection, they're not using very strong logic. The other part I think is very interesting. If there's no body in the tomb, that would probably explain why there was no shrine. Now, the lack of a body would explain this at the tomb of Jesus. This was a common thing that you did among popular people back in those days. You would have a shrine at the site of their burial. In fact, there was 50 such shrines at this time across Israel. And so I listed some of them: Reuben and Zebulun and Eleazar the priest and Jethro and Joshua and Hannah. They all had shrines that had been built over their supposed site of burial. That's just something that they did back in those days. I say back in those days, that is still the case in the Middle East today. I highlighted two of them. I highlighted Joshua and Joseph just because it's some of the things we've been talking about recently. The tomb of Joseph. Joseph is buried right there at the beginning of a valley between two mountains. It's Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, the two mountains that we've talked about over the last couple months ago. That is where the tomb of Joseph is. And there's a great shrine that was built to Joseph. There's only one little problem with that, is that that today is in Palestinian control. There have been fights between the Palestinians and the Israelis over the site of Joseph's tomb for the last 4,000 years. And in fact, I think the last bloody conflict was in 2008. So we're not talking about ancient history. The Jews were still trying to make pilgrimages to the holy site of the burial shrine of Joseph. And interesting. Some things never change. Now, the site of Joshua also had a tomb that was built. Joshua, supposedly, according to Jewish history, died on the 26th day of the month of Nisan. How you pronounce that. And so that became a Jewish, not a major holiday, but a somewhat of a minor holiday. And it's celebrated even to this day. And Jews still make the pilgrimage out to where Joshua's tomb is, his shrine, even to this day. I think that's kind of interesting. Why wasn't there a shrine built at the bones of Jesus? Because there were no bones of Jesus. The tomb was empty. I think that's interesting. Talk about eyewitnesses. I think we've got kind of a circumstantial case built right now that the tomb was empty. There has to be a reason for it. And I believe the strongest thing we can make of our case is the idea of eyewitnesses. What was the ninth commandment? The ninth commandment, according to Deuteronomy 19 and 15, one witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. The Jews were taught from a very early age, you shall not bear false witness. You had to be a truthful eyewitness. And the account was plain. One witness could not condemn a man. You had to have the mouth of two or three. The idea and the concept of being an eyewitness was an integral part of the law of Moses. And the Jews knew that. In the time of Christ, the Jews understood the importance of being an eyewitness. The need for eyewitness accounts was paramount before the Jews would be convinced of anything. Now let's turn to 1 Corinthians 15 chapter. Isn't that exactly what the Apostle Paul is doing? The Apostle Paul is giving a list of actual eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ so that anyone could double check and fact find as they saw fit. He says in verse 3, "For I delivered to you first of all that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that He was buried, and that He rose again the third day according to the Scriptures." And now He's going to begin to list eyewitnesses. "And that He was seen by Cephas, then by the 12. And after that He was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that He was seen by James, then by all the apostles. Then last of all, He was seen by me also, as by one born out of doomed time." What's the purpose of this passage? Why would the Apostle Paul go to such length to list the people that saw Jesus after He was resurrected? Why would he make this comment, "of whom the greater part remain to the present"? Why would he make such a big point of this? It's because they were eyewitnesses to this account. Law of Moses said you had to have two or three. The Apostle Paul just listed well over 500. And says, listen, most of them are still alive today. Go talk to them. You want to hear an eyewitness account? Go talk to Peter. Go talk to one of the apostles. Go talk to one of the 500 brethren. Go talk to James. Go talk. He was giving an eyewitness list. No different than what would happen in any court case today. But we're not talking about one eyewitness or two or three. Paul lists 500. And he doesn't even list all of them. Now the Bible talks about several eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There was Mary Magdalene. There was the woman referred to as the other Mary. There was Salome, Joanna. There was another unnamed woman that the Bible doesn't give us her name, but she was with the group. Peter, Cleopas, that was the man who was on the road to Emmaus. There was the companion of Cleopas. We don't know his name, but remember how there was two men walking on the road to Emmaus when the resurrected Lord appeared. The Bible refers to him as the 11, with Thomas absent. Well, actually, I guess it was 10. And then there was referred to again the 11, this time with Thomas in their presence. There were 7 disciples one day at the Sea of Tiberias. That's where they were going fishing. There was the 500 brethren of the 500 disciples mentioned in Galilee. There was James, the half-brother of Jesus that Paul mentioned. And there were unnamed disciples at the Ascension. It doesn't tell us exactly who was there that witnessed the Ascension. There are hundreds of eyewitnesses that were mentioned concerning the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Why was it so important to have eyewitnesses? Well, so people could fact check. People could ask questions. People could interview and they could cross-examine and determine if what people were saying was true. The law of Moses required 2 or 3. We have so many more eyewitness accounts than that. What about the women at the tomb? Matthew 28:1. Now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. I have a question for you here. You think there's significance to the fact that the first witnesses of the empty tomb being the women? Think that's interesting? Well, if you were a Jew, that would be pretty interesting. I say it, because under Jewish law, it took the testimony of 2 women to equal the testimony of 1 man. And even in that case, they still may not believe it. Testimony of women didn't hold much water in ancient Israel. In fact, do you remember what happened? Even the apostles. The women came running back to tell them that the tomb was empty. Even the apostles did not believe the women. They did not believe the testimony of the women. So is it important? Is there an important fact there? Because why in the world, if the Bible is a farce and this whole story is a lie, why would you pick the least believable witnesses to tell the account? Does that make sense, does it? The reason is because that's the way that it happened. And the women were the first one. The disciples were also told to remain in Jerusalem. Luke 24:49 says, "Behold, I send the promise of my Father upon you, but tarry in the city of Jerusalem until you are endued with power from on high." Now question, why were the disciples told to remain in Jerusalem? Is there a reason for that? There was a couple months there that they remained in Jerusalem waiting for this power to come on high. Why? The only answer I can give you is they were eyewitnesses. They were eyewitnesses to the account of the resurrection, and that way they could be questioned by anyone and everyone at the temple, outside the temple, as they went to the market. Anyone could question these eyewitnesses. There would be no doubt in the minds of the Jews. Many believed that they saw Jesus. Some accepted the fact that the disciples believed that they saw Jesus, but they tried to explain this away. Well, they were seeing what they wanted to see. It's tricks of the subconscious. They were hallucinations. They were dreams. They would accept the fact that people thought they saw Jesus, but they won't accept the fact that it was real. In other words, they saw what they wanted to see, whether it was real or not. And that's going to lead me to my final point here. Is this enough to produce the type of conversions that follow? So let's talk about some of the conversions that we read about in the New Testament. 2 in particular. First, let's talk about James, this half-brother of Jesus. According to John chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, it says none of the brethren of Jesus believed him. None of them believed him, including James. I'm going to assume, and I kind of put this with my thought here, the BDN is mine, I'm going to assume that James was probably absent at the crucifixion. And the supposition that I make is based upon the fact Jesus is hanging there upon the cross. He looks down to the apostle John, and he says to John, he sees his mama standing there, "Behold your mother." And he tells Mary, "Behold your son." If James was a faithful follower, and his brother was sitting there in the crowd, something of this tells me that Jesus would not have overlooked James, his fleshly brother, to try to tell John to take care of his mama. Something just tells me that James probably wasn't even at the crucifixion. He was not a believer. In 1 Corinthians 15 and 7, though, we did read that James saw the resurrected Jesus, and almost instantly, James became a great leader of the church, the congregation at Jerusalem. In fact, the book of Galatians refers to him as a pillar of the church. What in the world could cause such a change of heart in this man, James? The second conversion is a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus was one of the greatest persecutors of the church. He loved arresting Christians, and he thought he was doing it for the right reason. He was standing there at the feet of Stephen as he was stoned to death. He loved it. He thought he was doing the best work that God wanted him to do. Acts 9 and 5 tells us, though, that Saul of Tarsus saw the resurrected Jesus on the road to Damascus. And almost instantly, he became a great leader of the church and responsible for the writing of the majority of the New Testament. What in the world would cause such a change of heart in Saul of Tarsus? And you see, there's a connection that they saw the resurrected Jesus. They became eyewitnesses of the resurrection. And from that point, their lives were completely and totally changed. People had to give up a lot to be Christians. You know, we think we give up a lot sometimes to be Christians. Let me tell you, it was a whole lot more back in those days. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Apostle Paul, and I'm going to use him as kind of a representative of early Christians because I think they probably all faced some of these trials. Paul says, from the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. See, under Jewish law, you could beat somebody 40 times. They normally beat them 39 just to make sure they didn't miscount. Because if you beat a Jew over 40 times, then you got the same punishment. So to make sure that they didn't accidentally miscount, they would just hit them 39 times. So Paul says, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. 1 day and 1 night I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. In the world would cause the Apostle Paul to go through that. And not only Paul, what would cause these other disciples to go through all of that torture and those hardships? It's reported that 10 of the 12 apostles were executed for their faith. Most in the most horribly inhumane way that you could ever imagine. What in the world would cause people to do that? Were they getting rich over Christianity? Not at all. They lost every monetary thing that they had. They were counting on the support of strangers. Is it because they became world famous and got to live in a big house like and had their own reality TV show like the Kardashians? No, they were despised throughout the world. They didn't have anyone they could trust. Half the time the people, remember Paul said, he said, my own countrymen, my own brethren, the people he thought he could trust were coming after him. Was it because they got into the best schools? Their children were able to go to the best schools and the best universities? Not at all. What in the world would possess people like James and Saul of Tarsus to follow this? Well, I think there's two options. You know, the disciples forsook their homes, their welfare, their peaceful lives, their families, their money. They forsook everything in the name of the resurrection of Jesus. Why were they able to do this? Why were they willing? Well, there's two options that I can think of, two logical options why the disciples were willing to go to such lengths to stand up and preach and believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Number one is the Jewish belief. And this is what the Jews were trying to sell, that the disciples were all engaged in the greatest scam that the world has ever known. And so that was what they were teaching. Jesus, he wasn't resurrected. They came and stole the body while he was asleep. And it's all a lie. And everything you hear about Jesus is a lie. So I want you to think about this. According to the Jewish belief, the early Christians knowingly accepted a lie, even to the point of death. They taught this lie throughout Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and eventually the entire world for absolutely no tangible reason. Many of the first-hand witnesses were killed in horrible ways that we can't even imagine in defense of this lie, yet no one ever recanted the truth or this lie and told the truth. That's what the Jews want us to believe. That all of these folks, these eye-hand, first-hand witnesses who knew that someone supposedly came and stole the body, no one ever backed out of this lie, even if it meant it cost them their own life. That's kind of hard to swallow. I came across this quote. I thought this was pretty good. Liars do not make good martyrs. Because eventually, the liar will back out. If it's not real, the liar will not go to the point of death. But yet the apostles were willing to. All these early disciples, they were willing to do this. And the Jewish opinion is, well, it's all a lie. It's all a scam. It was all made up. Well, that's hard to believe. So the only other option I can think of is the Christian belief. And that is that everything happened exactly as the Bible said. That's why they were willing to go to such extremes. That's why we saw such great conversions in the life of James and Saul of Tarsus, is because they believed the resurrection as witnesses. They believed exactly what the Bible says. The most logical explanation for all of these accepted historical facts is that Jesus was resurrected from the dead, just as the Bible teaches. So in conclusion, there's a term. It's called inference to the best explanation to determine validity of an event. That's kind of some fancy jargon there. But what that means is, when something happens, we try to figure out what's the most logical explanation of a series of events. The more facts that you have, the less plausible solutions occur. We had 12 facts that everyone seems to agree with concerning the resurrection. Whether you believe in the resurrection or not, there was 12 historical facts. That's a pretty good sample size. And I want to know, what's the most logical explanation of all of these facts that we've talked about this morning? Now, it's kind of a legal lesson, so you know I can't get through a legal lesson because I'm not a lawyer, but I do watch Judge Judy. Judge Judy says, if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a dove, because it's a duck. She also likes to say, well, if it doesn't make sense, it's probably not true. And so that's kind of a logical way of looking at this, inference to the best explanation. What that means is, what is the most logical way to explain all the events that we've talked about? How can we explain this empty tomb? How can we explain the fact that there were so many people who instantly believed around the area of Jerusalem? How can we explain the fact that James, this brother of Jesus, who was not a believer, suddenly becoming a believer and a leader of the church? How can we explain the fact that the Apostle Paul, who was out to destroy the church, all of a sudden turned to 180? And was now one of the greatest supporters of the church? How can we explain the fact that all of these people that we read about were willing to give their lives for something that was talked about that seemed so out of place? Well, the best explanation I can give you is these 12 historical facts, generally accepted by most scholars, is that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead, just like the Bible teaches. And that is by far the strongest case that I can make for the resurrection. I don't know if you noticed this. The first five books of Acts This was the central message of the church, was the concept of the resurrection. Go through and read this. The resurrection is mentioned every time Peter preaches a sermon. He'll make a comment, Jesus, whom you crucified, but our God has raised from the dead. He'll make a comment about that. Read the sermons that are listed in the first five chapters of Acts, and you will see a common thread. Every sermon goes back to the resurrection. And all of a sudden, remember the day of Pentecost? How many people were converted? Was it two? Six? Was it a really good day? We had 14 converted to the gospel? No, there was thousands that were converted. How was that possible? Because there was eyewitness accounts of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that was the message that they taught there on the first sermon at the church began. I think it's an interesting lesson. So I hope I've made my case this morning, the case for the resurrection. I can't think of another logical explanation other than the fact that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead just as the Bible taught. And that's why we're all here today. That's why we're here still worshiping the Lord. That's why we're going to gather around the Lord's table here in a few minutes, is because we believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That concludes my thoughts for the day. The lesson is yours. We never like to close, though, without having a song of invitation. If there's any who need the help of the church, stand ready to assist.